This is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio. Catholic Review Radio is a weekly radio program and podcast hosted by Catholic Review Media, the news operation of the Archdiocese of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic partners for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to our listeners each week.
Welcome to Catholic Review Radio. As the world mourns Pope Francis, who died April 21st at age 88, this episode will look at a few ways he has affected and inspired people, and look ahead at the upcoming conclave to elect his successor. We will talk today with Archbishop William Laurie, Cardinal Edwin O'Brien, and retired Vatican journalist John Thavis. First up is Archbishop Laurie.
Over the years, you've encountered Pope Francis many times, through the Knights of Columbus, the USCCB leadership, the Synod. What's been your experience of being with him?
The Pope is always very kind and very welcoming, very open to what it is we wanted to share with him, whether it was the Supreme Knight speaking on behalf of 2 million Knights of Columbus, or the president of the Bishops' Conference really speaking on behalf of all the bishops of the United States. Holy Father is very involved. He listens actively. He will interject. He will ask questions. And he manifests in the middle of all of that a really nice sense of humor. So it is really enjoyable to speak with Pope Francis. I've enjoyed every one of those encounters.
Is that usually done in English, or is it, does somebody translate for him?
He understands a lot of English and does not need translations for much of what is said. However, if you lob a compound complex sentence across the desk, he might turn to an interpreter. He will speak a little bit in English, but often he replies in Italian. And the sometimes all of us understand what he is saying, and sometimes we have to also rely on the interpreter. But also like to recall the ad limina visit that the bishops of our region and a neighboring region had with him. It's about 35, 37 of us maybe, all gathered in his library at the Vatican. It's a large room, and they set up chairs, and he sat at the head of the room with an interpreter next to him, that's all. Mm-hmm. And he opened the meeting with a prayer, and after that he told us where the bottled water could be found and where the bathrooms were. And then I actually never knew where the bathrooms were in that room, but I now know.
Now you know.
And
that was 2019, right?
Yes. And for the next hour and a half, he took questions from us. He didn't give us an address. He wanted to know what was on our minds. And bishops felt free to speak very forthrightly, to describe often the pastoral challenges that they are facing, some of the obstacles they encounter. And the Holy Father was engaged the whole time. It was also the occasion when I presented my seminarians, and we gave him a Ravens jersey as well. He didn't wear it, but he really liked it.
That's cool.
And commented on it as I was leaving the room. He commented on it. So what I found remarkable, though, about that was that he would simply open himself up to take questions from that many bishops all at once. I did feel sorry for his interpreter, because yeah, by the time the hour and a half was over, the Pope was going strong, but his interpreter was really tired.
Lagging a little bit, yeah. The Pope has introduced some new conversation about some things, especially about the environment, about his approach to the joy of the gospel, pastoral accompaniment, especially for those who are divorced or in irregular marriages, the LGBT community, and some others. How has Pope Francis changed not the church's teaching, but the way the church approaches ideas and central truths?
It sounds almost hackneyed to say it, but I think we can easily and readily describe Pope Francis as a pastoral pope. As Archbishop of Buenos Aires, he was very close to his people, not just because he rode the bus to work, but because he waded into some of the major pastorally challenging situations that existed in his archdiocese. He knew his priests, he knew his people. And I think he brought that pastoral spirit to the papacy. This is not to say his predecessors were not pastoral, but Pope Francis brings a certain realism and earthiness to his ministry. When he became pope, he prayed, and I think the answer he got was that he should be himself, to be who he is, not to try to be a predecessor, not to try to meet everybody's expectation, but to be himself. And I think we've seen that play out over these years. I have found that his approach has been very helpful to me and to my co-workers in carrying forward the various ministries in the archdiocese, chief of which is evangelization. My pastoral letters, A Light Brightly Visible, are very much shaped by what the Holy Father has written about pastoral ministry, about parish life, especially in The Joy of the Gospel, but many other writings as well. His love for immigrants has shaped not only what I have said about the large and growing immigrant community in the Archdiocese of Baltimore, it's also shaped how we have done pastoral ministry in and among that community and the kinds of services that we strive to provide and the way in which we are striving to cope with present challenges to the immigrant community. My pastoral letter to the LGBT community, Like Every Disciple, very much shaped by Pope Francis's pastoral approach. One of the hallmark initiatives of his papacy is this synodality. We have strived very hard to not only do the preliminaries, but to make synodality not a program and not a means to an end, but what the Pope said it ought to be, the ordinary way we relate to one another and operate within the church. So I would say that he has had a massive influence on the Church of Baltimore and on its current shepherd.
Mm-hmm. I saw kind of early on in his papacy, probably about a year in, somebody posted photos of John Paul, Benedict, and Francis side by side and said, John Paul told us, here's what the church teaches. Benedict said, here's why the church teaches what it does. And Francis said, now go do it.
I think that's a very fine summary.
Yeah. You talked about the encounters with the Pope. A year after the Freddie Gray riots, you took a small group of interfaith leaders from Baltimore to meet the Pope and to ask for prayers for the city. What did he say in your conversation with him at that time?
The Holy Father was very encouraging. I think he encouraged us, first of all, to stand together, to bear a united witness to Christ in this very challenging situation, not just the temporary unrest that resulted from Freddie Gray, but the ongoing challenges within the city of Baltimore and its environs. And he certainly also encouraged us to love and serve the poor. He always said, Do not forget the poor is one of his signature lines. And he also encouraged us to really work for justice, fight gun violence, fight drugs, and help families attain their dignity. And it was all kind of done very quickly. It was at the end of an audience, but it was a very beautiful encounter.
And you've continued that with now, you know, the Archdiocese has started the grief ministry and started some emphasis on mental health. And so there are a number of initiatives, I think, that have seemed like they've grown out of that, right?
Very much so. I think that the church, in order to be credible, has to be present. And being present means more than being there. Being present means engaging with those in need and in their actual situations. COVID certainly brought out the immensity of the challenge we have regarding the mental health of many people. But frankly, it was there before. COVID didn't cause all that. I think it simply served to highlight it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the initiatives that I hope we will not only continue, but ramp up as we go into the future.
What's the most endearing thing about Pope Francis in your mind?
I think it's Pope Francis's closeness, his closeness to the poor, his willingness to go out and take risks for the poor, to remind us not to forget those who are in need, those who are newly arrived, those who are victims of war. I think that is a beautiful quality for which he will be long remembered.
After a short break, I'll talk with Cardinal Edwin O'Brien. You're listening to Catholic Review Radio.
Where can a Master of Theological Studies take you? At Loyola University, Maryland, our program prepares you for careers with nonprofits, religious ed, campus ministry, law, social work, and higher ed. Choose from 3 specialized tracks or our certificate in theology and ministry. Experience small classes, mentoring, networking opportunities, and more. Apply by August 1st for this fall. Learn more at loyola.edu/theology.
Our next guest is Cardinal Edwin O'Brien, former Archbishop of Baltimore and retired Grand Master of the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre. We spoke with him via phone from Rome.
When you and I last talked, one of the things that you said was that you didn't think the Pope would get out of the hospital, and he did. He was very strong and got out of the hospital. Were you surprised to see him at so many events in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, I think we all were. It wasn't the best sight because it was clear that he was not himself.
No.
But it indicated a very determined individual. And I think that has marked his papacy and certainly his last weeks and months. But a lot of stamina, physical, put all into it, but psychic and psychological and spiritual. He was totally immersed in what was around him.
It seems appropriate that he passed away on Easter Monday, having greeted the crowds at the Urbi et Orbi one more time. What do you think kind of message that sends people that you can be resilient, that with the hope in Christ you can persevere?
Yeah, I think he would hang on that long only because of his commitment that this was the will of God, and Christ was with him, and Christ was guiding his steps, present and future, and was willing in faith to leave that up to the Lord. And it proved to be very providential.
Yeah.
As you said, the timing was wonderful with Easter Sunday, where he was relatively active and drove through the piazza, which was wonderful. I think he'd have it no other way. And
yeah,
he went peacefully from what they say.
Oh, that's good. What's the mood in Rome right now?
Well, it's solemn. It's somber. People are living day to day to the events of the funeral preparation.
Right.
Still not focused yet on what the conclave is going to bring. I think there are only 60 cardinals today at the consistory, but that's filling up in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by the time Saturday comes and the funeral, the emphasis is going to change a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it's all focused on his memory and his accomplishments and the extraordinary attention Hipstead has brought to the church and to his own pontificate.
Are you going to participate in the general congregation?
I don't expect to. No,
okay.
I expect to pray on the sides, including the funeral. And I'm feeling good, and I don't want to presume on my health. But
yeah.
They don't need me, and they need my prayers, and that's what they'll have.
Anything else I missed?
Now it's just organizational. People are still coming in, and they will probably, right until the time of the funeral, the cardinals will be arriving. Archbishop Loria is coming in, I think, one of these days. But as here at Rome, there's a lot of coverage, and I'm sure everybody's following the various networks because they're really swarming all over the place.
Yeah.
And it shows the great public interest that this Pope has generated over the years. And the love, too.
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
He had such a big impact right away.
Yep. Okay. Smell of the sheep is something he lives. And I think people, without saying those words, people knew that he was as close as he could be to what they were going through all around the world. It's just amazing.
John Thavis is the former bureau chief of Catholic News Service in Rome. I talked to him via Zoom about what goes into a conclave. We're talking now with John Thavis, who is the former bureau chief for Catholic News Service Rome Bureau. He's been in Rome for the last four papal transitions. Welcome, John. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Tell our listeners a little bit about just what happens during a conclave.
What happens during a conclave is essentially laid out in a document written by St. Pope John Paul II, who established rules. He revamped the rules for a conclave, which, of course, have been modified over the centuries. Essentially, the conclave in modern times takes place in two phases. The first is convening the cardinals, all of the cardinals, those over the age of 80 and under, for several days of discussions. And generally, these discussions last about a week, and they're meant to be less formal discussions than take place once the actual conclave begins. So these are pre-conclave meetings, and they take place under the guidance of leading cardinals. The locked-in part of the conclave takes place in the Sistine Chapel, of course, and that's under lock and key. It's hermetically sealed. No news gets out. So for a journalist, the first part of the conclave is in some ways more interesting. The second part is probably a little bit scarier because we have no idea who's going to appear on the balcony as Pope.
So during the sealed-in part, there is a lot of waiting and waiting and waiting, right?
Exactly. You're waiting for the smoke, and then you're waiting to figure out, is the smoke black or white? Of course, there have been many, many incidents over the years regarding smoke that could not be determined black or white. And in fact, I can remember the very first conclave that I was present for in St. Peter's Square. It looked like black smoke. This was in 1978 when Pope John Paul I was elected. It looked like black smoke. So we all started leaving the square, and then a loudspeaker kicked in and said, come back. It's white smoke. So, that system had to be perfected, and they actually have it down pretty well now. When Pope Francis was elected, there seemed to be no doubt it was white smoke.
Mm-hmm. Originally, it was they just put wet straw in with the ballots, and that's what caused the dark smoke. And if it wasn't that, then it was white smoke. Now they're using chemical canisters to create that effect, right?
That's right. They decided that the whole wet straw thing wasn't working very well.
Yeah.
So they set up a separate stove, which is joined with the original stove that does burn the ballots, and they inject chemical canisters, it took them one or two conclaves to get that right as well.
There's a lot of ritual involved in this, correct? I mean, this is based not only in votes, but there's a lot of prayer and maybe not drama, but very serious kinds of elements of this, right? What are those elements?
Right. Again, it's different for each phase. So the first phase, called the general congregations, where the cardinals are meeting and conversing, the ritual, there are prayers, but the ritual is pretty loose. And in fact, the cardinals can determine pretty much how they want to proceed. Once they get locked into the Sistine Chapel, it is almost every move is written down. Obviously, they're handed ballots. They are supposed to fill out the ballots in a certain form to place them on a paten, which is then put into a receptacle. The votes are counted in another ritual. And it's interesting, Pope John Paul II's instructions actually instructed the cardinals to write in handwriting that could not be recognized as their own. That's the level of secrecy he wanted, and it's been maintained.
Wow. After Pope John Paul II died, that had been the first conclave in like 26 years, but you were kind of ready for that. You'd been following the Vatican for a while at the time. Did you have a couple of people that you thought were possible popes that you had bios ready to go as soon as the vote was announced?
I did, in fact. I had one who was Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who in fact was elected pope, mainly because those of us who had been covering the Vatican for that long, we really couldn't conceive of anybody else coming in. And he seemed to be the one person who would represent continuity with Pope John Paul II. However, I did also have an alternate, and that was Cardinal Diego Tettamanzi of Milan, who was the Italian favorite going into the conclave. The idea was that perhaps after a Polish pope, that the cardinals would return to the norm, so to speak, and elect an Italian. But that obviously did not happen and still hasn't happened.
Right. And then by the time that Pope Benedict announced his resignation, you had already retired from Catholic News Service. You had written a book, The Vatican Diaries. If you're interested in this stuff, it's a fascinating look at some of the stories behind the scenes at the Vatican. Became a fairly instant bestseller, perhaps because of the timing, but because it's so well written. But when you were then in 2013, you were there when Pope Benedict announced his resignation. What were you doing with ABC News to help them understand the what was going on?
They hired me to do on-air commentary. And in fact, it was rather providential timing on somebody's part that my book came out right when Pope Benedict resigned, because really no book had been written about the Vatican in years and years and years. And so I was rather besieged by media requests and eventually ended up working on the set overlooking St. Peter's Square with all the ABC news anchors and waiting for the white smoke, just like they were. I had an advantage, you might say, because I actually knew who some of the candidates were. And a few days before that conclave began, I made a point of going around and talking to some of the cardinals. Now, the cardinals who were going to be in the Sistine Chapel were basically not talking. They had been told not to talk, and they weren't talking very much at all. But I knew that the cardinals over the age of 80, who had been in the initial meetings but would not be going into the Sistine Chapel, that they also had opinions. So I talked to several of them, and I think three or four of them mentioned Cardinal Bergoglio of Argentina. as one potential candidate. And I immediately thought, okay, he's older, he's 76, but if I get that from three or four cardinals, it's worth blogging about, which I did. And I singled him out as a candidate, which of course helped my reputation as a prophesier later in life. But it also helped me on the set when the white smoke happened and they announced his name, because I actually knew who he was. And I knew the details about his life and was able to fill the void, as it were.
Mm-hmm. So we've got just a little bit of time left. We're going to be on the air the day after the funeral. About how long after that can we expect the conclave to begin and to bring us a new pope?
Well, that's a good question, and it may not be decided until right after the funeral, because the last time this happened in 2013, a lot of cardinals wanted a longer time ahead of the actual conclave to talk about these choices and to talk about what qualities they were looking for in a pope. But the cardinals running the general congregation said, 1 week is enough. Let's start the conclave. It was about 10 days after the papal funeral in 2005 when the conclave began. And they pretty much stuck to the idea that we only need 5 days of conversations before we can go in and start voting. Now, whether that happens this time, who knows? There is going to be debate about it. So it could happen, I think, as early as 10 days after the Pope's funeral, or it could go on a little longer. We'll have to see.
That is something for us to watch for. We've been talking with John Thavis, the former bureau chief of Catholic News Service in Rome and the author of The Vatican Diaries and The Vatican Prophecies. Thanks so much for being with us, John.
Yeah, my pleasure, Chris.
Our guests today were Baltimore Archbishop William Lurie, Cardinal Edwin O'Brien, retired Grand Master of the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre, and John Thavis, former bureau chief of Catholic News Service in Rome and author of The Vatican Diaries. Thank you for joining us today for this special Papal Transition edition of Catholic Review Radio. For our print readers, watch for a special print edition of the Catholic Review magazine, which will be delivered around May 1st. This is Chris Gunty, and you're listening to Catholic Review Radio.